Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here we go again, and I hope you're learning this rhyme, because I'm going to be testing you at the end of the series. Willy, Willy, Harry, Stee, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3, 1, 2, 3, Neds, Richard, 2, Henry's, 4, 5, 6, then who? Edward, 4, 5, Dick the Bad, Harry's Twain and Ned the Lad, Mary, Bessie, James, Evane, Charlie, Charlie, James again, William and Mary, Anna, Gloria, 4 Georges, William. We come to William the 4th, the last Hanoverian king. Queen Victoria was the last Hanoverian monarch, but as I say, William was the last king. And he's one of those monarchs who sort of, well, nobody really knows that much about, nobody really cares. He only was on the throne for 7 years. Before Charles III came to the throne, he was the oldest monarch to have come to the throne when he was 64. And, at the time when most people are thinking about retirement, he had to suddenly become king. And he didn't really like all the sort of pomp and ceremony and self-importance of being king. He'd been in the Navy and was nicknamed the Sailor King. And he had that sort of bluff, no-nonsense, I'm a Navy man, I don't need all this frippery and finery, I'll just wear my tatty old jumper. So he was in marked contrast to his older brother George, who had reigned as George the Fourth and loved dressing up and wearing loads of jewels. And his coronation had been wildly expensive. And William at first said, oh, we don't need a bloody coronation. We don't go through with all that nonsense. But it was decided that he really should be officially crowned. But his coronation cost a fraction of George's. In fact, there was a law in place about the least amount that you were allowed to spend on a coronation, which was £30,000 at the time. He managed to spend a little bit more than that. So as well as being called the Sailor King, a lot of people called him the Pineapple because of the shape of his head, which if you can picture Grandpa Simpson, the shape of his head was very similar to that. It was sort of pulled up into a dome at the top with a sprout of hair. And in Grandpa Simpson's case, that hair is yellow. But William, by the time he came to the throne, had a shock of white hair sprouting out the top of his pineapple head. A lot of people called him eccentric, I think, because he didn't want to live the life of a king. At the coronation, he was sort of laughing and chuckling at the whole business. It was sort of a feeling that it was a bit of a pantomime, a bit of a sort of comic opera. And famously, when he was staying at the Royal Pavilion, this amazing royal palace that his brother George had built in Brighton, when he turned up, he'd get someone to sort of visit all the local hotels and see who was staying there. And if there was anyone he thought he'd like to meet or he already knew or was a little bit famous, he'd invite them round to dinner with a note saying, no need to dress. I don't care about these things. And he was fond of kind of wandering the streets and meeting his public until there was this political business known as the Reform Crisis, which I will come on to later, but it became very controversial and it was never quite sure which side William was on. And if the public thought he was on the wrong side, they'd throw things at his coach and insult him in the street. So he had to rein in his love of wandering the streets and talking to people. All his life, he had a bit of a temper. It got better as he got older. After he was married, he did calm down a bit. It seemed his wife sort of, as many wives do, settled him down and looked after him and sorted him out. But particularly when he was a child, he was very quick to anger and to fight people. And His father, George III, was a strict parent and one of these sort of upper class parents who believed that their children should be regularly beaten and forced to behave properly and not become arrogant and stuck up. I mean, they failed every time, but there you go. So his anger aside, it seemed that William, well, he was sort of a bit lazy, but he wanted to steer a middle path to keep things simple. He didn't want any trouble. He didn't really want all the business that goes with being a king. He was not an intellectual giant. He was probably a bit thick, but he didn't care about these things. And he wasn't particularly interested in the arts and culture like his brother George and his father George. Actually, on that front, I should have said before, in case you haven't been following the whole story, that William came to the throne because his elder brother George, George IV, didn't have any legitimate children. So the line of succession went to William. So it's quite tricky doing this episode because the events of William's life I've pretty much extensively covered when we looked at both George III and George IV, because George III lived an incredibly long time. So by the time his son George IV came to the throne, he was pretty elderly. And as I say, when William came to the throne, he was even older. So they share so many events of their lives before William became monarch. And I think the best thing that can be said of William when he was monarch was that he managed to do no harm. Actually, it's a bit more than that, because there was revolution sort of bubbling under throughout Europe following the French Revolution. So many people are thinking, well, couldn't we have one of our own? And this was spread throughout Europe. And of course, in England, too, there was a great deal of unrest from the what would have been called the lower classes at the time. And as I say, when I come on to talking about the Reform Bill, I'll go into that in a bit more detail. But William, by trying to steer this middle path, by trying not to get too involved, by trying to preserve the status quo, he did manage to stop England from descending into revolution. Now, some people might say, well, that's a terrible thing. We needed a revolution. And probably more people would say, no, revolutions in the end just cause widespread violence and destruction and the ruination of people's lives. And William, because to start with, he had never expected to be monarch. After George III, he was the third in line to the throne. He was allowed to do things that his older brothers weren't. He was a classic spare. He was a spare once removed. And it was kind of like, certainly to start with, oh, he can go off and join the Navy. It doesn't really matter if he gets killed. No one will really notice. Also, his father, King George III, had this attitude, a bit like the sort of stuffy old farts today who say that young people should be forced to join the army. Bring back national service, very character building. OK, so maybe they'll get shot and killed, but they'll go to their graves with nice short haircuts and a respect for discipline. So George III explicitly told the higher officers in the Navy to treat young William harshly, to make a man of him. But through joining the Navy, it perhaps gave him a greater understanding of the lives of people outside the royal circle. So William had a fairly strict upbringing. And then, at the age of 13, he joined the Royal Navy as a midshipman. A midshipman is kind of the entry level for officers in the Navy, the lowest rank. And he joined the squadron of an Admiral Digby. Now, it seems extraordinary to us today that 13-year-olds would be officers in the Royal Navy, or would be working at all, particularly in the sort of fairly brutal conditions on a Navy ship at the time. But this was considered quite normal. Child labour was widespread at the time. Children were stuck up chimneys. They were given all sorts of jobs. But it was actually during William's reign that the child labour laws were changed in the favour of children. I mean, kids went to work still very young, but things were definitely improved. In fact, there were lots of improvements on that front in William's reign. The poor law was updated. Slavery was fully abolished in nearly all of the British Empire I think it carried on in parts of India. Because earlier, the slave trade had been abolished, but now the ownership of slaves was abolished. And if you want to learn about that in more detail, then do listen to the episode I recorded with Onyeka Nubia, a fascinating look at the history of black people in Britain and the history of slavery in Britain. So William, in those 7 short years on the throne where he was trying not to get too involved, did manage to be at the helm when quite a lot of good was done. But he wasn't at the helm when he started the Navy. As I say, he was on the bottom rung of the ladder. He did get fairly rapidly promoted during the 11 years he was in the Navy. We looked at the Royal Navy in another earlier episode with James Hawes, one of the episodes on George III. There was this idea in the Navy that you were promoted through merit rather than coming from a good family. There was also this idea that the quickest way you could get promotion was when officers above you were killed in battle. Obviously, once you get to the very top, you start retiring and taking on desk jobs back in England. But it was a fairly ferocious and gung-ho life in the Navy, and a fairly fatalistic one. William did get involved in a couple of battles and saw some experience. He mostly served out in the West Indies and up into Nova Scotia. And he fully threw himself into naval life. He was forever fighting with fellow junior officers. And he managed to get arrested with his shipmates. Like a bunch of Bullingdon toffs, he and some fellow officers drunkenly smashed up a brothel in Barbados, leaving Daddy to pay the bill. And after a drunken brawl in Gibraltar one time, he was thrown into prison there till, I guess, he must have pulled the classic, "Do you know who I am?" And he was released rather quickly. He served in New York during the American War of Independence, which made him the only member of the British royal family up to that point to actually visit America. And while he was in New York, George Washington put together this plan to kidnap him. But the details were leaked, I'm not sure who by, and William was protected. And not long after that, he was moved back to the Caribbean, where in 1785, he was made a lieutenant. And then a captain of the HMS Pegasus in 1786. And it was in that year that he was stationed in the West Indies under Horatio Nelson. And the two of them became good friends. Nelson wrote at one time that, at least in his professional life, William was superior to 2/3, I'm sure, of the naval list. And in attention to orders and respect to his superior officer, I hardly know his equal. They dined together almost every night. And when Nelson got married, William insisted on giving the bride away. So certainly at that point in their lives, they were close. Their friendship waxed and waned over the years following that. But I think ultimately William was quite proud to have been a friend of Nelson, and it certainly would have been one of the things, as an aging ex-naval man, that he would have bored people about at dinner parties. In 1787, he was given command of his own frigate, the Andromeda, and in 1790, he was made a rear admiral, so a fairly fast promotion, and you got to remember that he was still in his early 20s. But as it was becoming obvious that there were problems with the line of succession, that George IV wasn't producing any legitimate heirs, there was a danger that William might come to harm. And also, as we said, he wasn't the greatest officer in the world. He didn't really navigate it, if you'll pardon the expression, very well. Despite what Nelson had said about him, he wasn't a man who ultimately was the best person to put in charge. But anyway, one way or another, he was brought back to England. And although George III and Parliament kept promising him that he might once again be able to properly join the Navy and go back to sea, it never happened. They gave him various honorary positions, which I can't quite keep up with, the technical variations on being an admiral that meant that you were an admiral who sailed an office desk rather than an actual ship. But William wanted some kind of meaning to his life. He wanted to engage in some kind of useful activity. And he also needed money, and he kept pestering his father to make him a duke, because that came with a certain income. But his father was reluctant. He was fed up with his sons spending vast amounts of money, and he wanted to try and keep them under control. So William threatened to stand for the House of Commons, for the constituency of Totnes in Devon. Because we have these two branches of Parliament, the House of Commons, who are not noble, and the House of Lords, who are lords and dukes and whatever. And it was during William's reign that really the House of Commons became the more dominant half of Parliament. But as I say, William threatened to stand as an ordinary member of Parliament for the House of Commons. And George III was appalled at the idea and didn't want him to start sort of going around the country trying to gather support. So he made him the Duke of Clarence. It meant that William would have a say in Parliament still, but it wouldn't be as shameful as being in the House of Commons. And George supposedly said, "I well know it is another vote added to the opposition." Because George's sons at this stage were rebelling against their conservative Tory father and supporting the Whigs, the Liberals, as it were. Later in life, William sort of vacillated between the Tories and the Whigs, and no one's quite sure what he actually believed in. But he was nevertheless upholding the fine Hanoverian tradition of sons fighting with their fathers. So he ceased his active service in the Royal Navy in 1790. And when Britain declared war on France in 1793, he was very eager to serve his country and desperate to be given a command of some sort. It didn't happen. First, because he broke his arm falling down some stairs while drunk. But later on, he very foolishly, and he often was a foolish man, many people have called him stupid. Certainly his behaviour was not always thought through. And the things that he said, he was very fond of just blurting things out and speaking his own mind and making a fool of himself. But during his campaign to be given command in the war on France, he made a speech in the House of Lords opposing the war, which is not a good look for a general. Nobody's really going to be supporting a military commander who says, "We shouldn't be having this war in the first place." What you need is a general who says, "Come on, lads, let's go and kill all the bastards. Let's destroy France once and for all." So as it ended up, despite being made this sort of pretend admiral in 1798, he was never given a proper command through the whole of the Napoleonic Wars. In 1811, he was given another honorary position, Admiral of the Fleet. In 1813, he came close to the fighting. He visited the British troops who were fighting in the Netherlands, and he was watching the bombardment of Antwerp from up on a church steeple when he came under fire and a bullet went right through his coat. Again, another great dinner party anecdote for him. Now, I said earlier that it was during his reign that the slave trade was abolished, which is true, but during this time he spoke in the House of Lords against the abolition of slavery. The point he tried to make was that he had seen the living standards among free men in places like the Highlands of Scotland, and he claimed that their conditions were worse than that among the slaves in the West Indies. He might have been right on one level, and certainly there was a big problem, actually, which we looked at with Onyeka Nubia when the slaves were freed in the West Indies, that a lot of them did end up in much worse position and ended up in this position known as indentured labour, which is almost as bad as slavery. On one level, you are technically free, but they're treated very badly and paid very badly and, you know, not fed. But, you know, to say that actually a lot of people have it worse off than these slaves is kind of missing the point. I mean, he'd spent time in the West Indies, where obviously he had got to know plantation owners, and it seems he might have been slightly nobbled in a sort of lobbying manner by these plantation owners. And really, he just wanted to preserve the status quo. He didn't want trouble. But as I say, later on, he relented he didn't like extremism. He didn't like change. He even insulted William Wilberforce in the House of Lords, saying the proponents of the abolition are either fanatics or hypocrites. And in one of those classes, I rank Mr. Wilberforce. William didn't like fanatics as he saw them. But as I say, it was later on during his reign that he relented and slavery was finally abolished in most parts of the British Empire. William's private life was very interesting, quite curious. In 1791, he shacked up with an Irish actress called Dorothea Bland, who was better known by her stage name of Mrs. Jordan, or Dora Jordan. Now, she called herself Mrs. Because she got pregnant quite early on in her acting career, whilst not married, and it was a sort of disguise, to sort of claim that she was either someone's wife or someone's widow. And she was Mrs. Jordan because she had crossed the water from Ireland, and she was older than William. She already had a few children when they got together, but he fell in love with her and moved in with her. And at the beginning, she was sort of supporting him. He wasn't getting enough money from his father or from Parliament. She had an income as an actress. So he, despite being a member of the royal family, had less money than her. And they lived together for 20 years and had 10 children together. And everyone knew about this. And the satirists obviously had a bit of a field day at his expense. But yet it was allowed to happen. And it didn't seem to bring great disgrace on the royal family. You know, these princes were sort of expected to have mistresses and to be sowing their wild oats. But exactly as we've seen with his elder brother, George, and it seemed that William did look up to his elder brothers, George and Frederick, and wanted to emulate them in many ways, as younger brothers often do. And George IV had a very similar relationship with Maria Fitzherbert, living with her and having children with her. And repeating the pattern, George IV didn't manage to have any legitimate children. William IV, neither. He had 10 children with Mrs. Jordan. But when he eventually married Princess Adelaide, they had no surviving children. Hence Queen Victoria, William's niece, coming to the throne, which we will come to. So George III gave William a house in Bushy Park called Bushy House for his steadily growing family. And that became William's main residence until he became king. His London house, Clarence House, was one of these great Georgian buildings designed by John Nash. And William had a very contented domestic life in Bushy for 20 years. His illegitimate children were all given the surname Fitzclarence. Fitz obviously denoting their illegitimate status. Clarence because he was Duke of Clarence. And this setup lasted happily until 1811, when William told Mrs. Jordan that he was leaving her. It seemed the closer and closer he got to being king, the more he started to think about reorganizing his life. He also needed more money. And despite Mrs. Jordan's income from acting, he wasn't getting what he needed. So he wanted to find a better arrangement that might bring in more cash. He needed an official royal wedding to someone with some status, so that he would be given extra cash to run his official royal household. And Mrs. Jordan, she even to the end, she didn't have a go at him. She didn't write a kiss and tell memoir or try and cash in on it or say terrible things about him. She sort of felt a bit sorry for him. She was paid off with a settlement of £4,400 a year, which is nearly £350,000 in today's money, and custody of her children, on the condition that she did not go back to acting. And I suppose William was suddenly thinking, oh, this might look a bit disgraceful. But her children, particularly the men, were a right rum bunch. They caused William problems the whole the rest of his life, doing the Hanoverian thing of demanding money from their father. And one of their daughters married a guy who got into terrible debt, which Dora Jordan had to pay off. And so she started acting, and William took custody of the daughters and withdrew the maintenance money he'd been paying. And Dora Jordan's acting career was failing by this point as she was getting older and less in demand. I mean, God knows how she'd managed to do it in the first place with something like 15 children to look after. And in the end, she fled to France to escape her creditors, where she died completely penniless near Paris in 1816. She'd been banned from seeing any of her children for several years, and one of them had run up massive debts in her name. So she had a pretty miserable end. William, meanwhile, tried to get married to a string of wealthy heiresses. So these were young women who had money rather than titles, but he didn't get anywhere with that. And his father, and indeed his brother George, kept blocking it, saying he had to marry someone who was royal. Eventually, in 1818, William married a princess, Adelaide of Saxe-Meiningen. And that marriage lasted nearly 20 years until he died. And as I said before, it was a happy one. And Adelaide pretty much took him in hand, sorted out his finances, sorted out his life. And indeed, for the first year of marriage, they lived in Germany with a fairly sort of frugal lifestyle, which pleased William's father, George III. Adelaide had two daughters who were very short-lived and two miscarriages. And there was constant sort of gossip. Oh, the Queen is pregnant again, when she wasn't, which infuriated William throughout his reign. And he dismissed these rumours as damned stuff. Adelaide seems to have been a very popular queen, as is shown by the many pubs named after her, as well as Adelaide in Australia and numerous other places. And then George IV died in 1830. And William came to the throne, as I say, aged 64. And as I said before, he didn't like any pomp and ceremony, and he wanted to try and be a good king. He was aware that people had really turned against George IV. They thought he was a swine and a terrible king and an awful administrator. So William tried very conscientiously. He was a great conscientious plodder, to do the right thing, to talk to people, try to make sense of things. And the Prime Minister at the time, the Duke of Wellington, stated that he had done more business with King William in 10 minutes than he had with George IV in as many days. And this man at least wishes to make everybody happy, and everything he has done has been benevolent. William also tried to sort of anglicise the English court. He got rid of George's French chefs and his German band and replaced them with English ones to public approval. He was probably the sort of man who enjoyed marching bands but couldn't sit through a classical concert. He gave away much of George IV's art collection. Well, he gave it to the nation, which was a good thing. He cut back on the royal stud. George IV had spent an inordinate amount of money on horses. Oh, George had begun renovations on Buckingham Palace. William hated it. It's not the most beautiful building. And I've been inside it a few times. It's not a terribly comfortable place. William refused to live there. He tried to give it away. He tried to give it to the army to use as a barracks. He tried to give it to Parliament after the Houses of Parliament burned down in 1834. And as you'll probably know, the current Houses of Parliament are a Victorian creation, a sort of Gothic fantasy. They might look old, but they're not particularly. Charles Barry, a keen Gothic revivalist, was the architect chosen for the rebuild, but he had a lot of help from Augustus Pugin. The Lord's Chamber was completed in 1847 and the Commons in 1852. Most of the work was done by 1860, but it wasn't completely finished until the 1870s, nearly 40 years after the original medieval buildings had burned down. The only significant part of the Houses of Parliament that was saved from the fire was the Great Hall, Westminster Hall, which had been built for William II way back in 1097 and is still there today. So, yes, William tried to be a good king, tried to attend to matters of state to the best of his ability. And the big crisis of his realm is this idea of reform. Now, I mentioned before, but I'll go through it again. Representation of the British people was very poor at this time. The constituencies had been formed way back in the Middle Ages, and they were very unevenly and unfairly distributed, so that a big city like Manchester, which had grown up since then, had no members of Parliament at all, had no representation. And tiny little boroughs known as rotten boroughs, like probably the most famous of them, Old Sarum, which is down in Salisbury, had just 7 voters. So it was very easy to manipulate the vote. You'd simply go down and bribe these 7 people to vote for your candidate. And also there were great impediments to people being able to vote. Only a tiny proportion of people, even within areas that had had a lot of voters, not all of them were allowed to vote. There were a lot of restrictions put on it. So there was a big, big populist movement to change the system. And there was a big movement in Parliament from the Whigs, the Liberals, to change this system, to update it. And of course, there was massive pushback from the wealthy landowners because they didn't want to lose their power and their authority and their wealth. And we saw how there was this huge meeting of 60,000 people in St. Peter's Field in Manchester with various orators telling them how bad the system was and what they should do about it, where the troops and the local militia went in and it became known as the Peterloo Massacre. So there was a lot of unrest around the country about this and a big push, as I say, within Parliament, mainly within the House of Commons, to change things, to widen representation and make it more fair, to get rid of the rotten boroughs, to move eventually towards universal suffrage. Whenever a bill was put through, the House of Lords basically quashed it. Because the system was, and still is, that the House of Commons put together a bill, and once they've all agreed with it, it has to be signed off by the House of Lords. These days, that's sort of just rubber stamping it. But back then, the Lords held the upper hand. And the way of dealing with this was to create new dukes, new Lords, and stuff them into the House of Lords so that they would pass the bill. And William was very reluctant to do this at first, which meant that the populace that had been well on his side before turned against him, as I mentioned earlier. But eventually he gave in and he did create some new Lords on the understanding that once this was through, they'd be sort of dissolved and absorbed into the system. So this was the first big step towards universal suffrage. There was still a long way to go. A lot of working class men still had no representation and women weren't represented at all. It was going to be nearly 100 years before we got full representation. And even at the time when the suffragettes were fighting for women's rights to vote, not all men had the right to vote. So this was the big central feature of William's reign. Luckily for him and luckily for us, it went in the right direction, but he still didn't have an heir. And it looked like his niece Victoria, daughter of his deceased brother Edward, Duke of Kent, was going to be our next queen. But unfortunately, by this point, King William had massively fallen out with Victoria's widowed mother, the Duchess of Kent, also called Victoria, Princess Victoria of Saxe-Coburg-Saalfeld. It's interesting, actually, that at this point in history, the name Victoria was considered a weird foreign German name, not pleasant to British ears. The Duchess had brought up Victoria very strictly, hardly letting her out of her sight, terrified that she might come to some kind of harm or be corrupted in some way. So she was accompanied all the time and sort of wrapped in cotton wool. She wasn't even allowed to go down the stairs by herself without holding an adult's hand. And so Victoria said herself that she'd had a very miserable upbringing. She liked her Uncle William. She thought he was a bit odd and eccentric and occasionally quite an angry man, but she was rarely allowed to see him. The Duchess of Kent, as I say, was keeping Victoria close to herself. I think William thought that the Duchess had ideas above her station and was acting like a queen mother before William was even cold in his grave. And he felt that she was snubbing him. So William, though fond of Victoria, was rarely allowed to see her. And he knew that if he died before Victoria was 18, that her mother, the Duchess of Kent, would rule as a regent. And he hated the Duchess by this point and hated the idea that she might take over from him. And he was desperate to live long enough to allow Princess Victoria to directly accede. And famously, there was a big banquet at the palace where when they toasted William's health, He stood up and ranted, "I trust to God that my life may be spared for 9 months longer. I should then have the satisfaction of leaving the exercise of the royal authority to the personal authority of that young lady there," meaning Victoria, "and not in the hands of a person now near me who is surrounded by evil advisers and is herself incompetent to act with propriety in the situation in which she would be placed." At which point, the Duchess of Kent tried to leave, but was persuaded to stay, and Victoria burst into tears. As it was, William, who was unwell by this time, did manage to cling on until a month after Princess Victoria's 18th birthday. And when he was dying, Victoria wrote, "Poor old man. I feel sorry for him. He was always personally kind to me. He'd had asthma all his life, and died aged 71 of pneumonia, on top of heart and liver problems." So that's the end of King William. And because the crown passed to Victoria, none of the later kings and queens of the United Kingdom are his direct descendants. Although one of our prime ministers was descended from his illegitimate line, that being David Cameron. And join me after the break, where I'll be discussing King William with my guest, Roger Knight.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back. And my guest on this episode is Roger Knight. Roger had a long career as an archivist and museum curator in the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich, leaving as deputy director in 2000. And since then, he's worked at the University of Greenwich and the University of London. Roger's written a number of books on the Napoleonic period with a focus on naval history, such as his acclaimed biography of Nelson, The Pursuit of Victory, and most recently, Convoys, about the protection of trade in the Napoleonic Wars. He's also the author of William IV, A King at Sea, part of the Penguin Monarchs series. I can highly recommend this series, actually. If you're interested in finding out more about any of the kings and queens in this series, the Penguin Monarchs books are a great place to start. They're fairly short, all about 100 pages long, and pretty inexpensive. Plus, each one is, of course, written by an expert. So, Roger, welcome to the podcast. Now, would it be fair to say that your interest in William came from your background in British naval history?
Indeed, because I know that period well. I was asked to do it, and I knew of him before, but it was an interest really in the Navy as well as William IV.
How long of his early life was he actually actively at sea, as it were?
He was only actively at sea for about 11 years. When he was really very young, he took part in battles in the American War, where he showed a good deal of courage, if not much circumspection. And then he didn't really get promoted. The king just said, I think he ought to be in command of a ship. And he went through that period. And then after that time, he got promoted to be in the House of Lords. He criticized the government. He criticized the war. And not surprisingly, he didn't get any further. He was mixed up with the Navy right through his life, but it was only 11 years. In fact, hardly enough to call him the Sailor King from just that period. He wasn't much good at it. He thought he was part of the Navy, And I don't think the Navy thought he was much part of them.
I gather that one of the strengths of the Navy was the fact that you were largely promoted on merit rather than knowing the right people.
Absolutely. You had very tough exams, the lieutenant's exam when you were about 20. You had to be really skillful, and you had to have a whole lot of signatures saying that you knew all these things. Unsurprising, really. The Navy entrusted bits of capital equipment for young officers. They needed to know that they knew their stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting that you know, we don't always take on board the vast expense of building these ships. I mean, how large was the fleet at the time?
Well, of course, it varied usually from peacetime to wartime.
Mm.
But by the French Revolutionary War, where William was on the sidelines getting shouldered away, you had about 100 ships of the line, and you're something like 600 or 700 other warships. It's a very big organization.
And a very big employer of men. So is this still the period of press gangs?
It was a high period. There was a huge shortage, particularly as the wars went on. There was a huge shortage of skilled men. If to be an able seaman, you had to be pretty skillful. Those people were getting pretty short. And during the Napoleonic War, after that, it was very short. So yes, right up until 1815, the press gang was very much part of life.
I mean, I guess it can't have been a very attractive proposition, particularly during the war, to go into the Navy. I mean, were the sailors paid well? Was there an advantage if you were, like, from a very poor rural background?
You were paid, and of course, you were fed.
Yeah.
Which, to say the least, is quite important. And you were fed well. And if you weren't fed well, you couldn't sail the ship. So the victualling and all that side of it was pretty efficient. And the merchant seamen, all the merchant ships, were paid more, but you had a lot of desertion from naval ships to merchant ships because of the difference in pay. Around the seaports, it wasn't much fun during wartime, particularly if you were a seaman. And of course, it was fairly obvious you're a seaman. You wear rough clothes and you walk with a gait because you've been on a ship all the time. The press gang would be after you.
I think William spent most of his naval career sort of around the West Indies. And, you know, it must have been serving in the heat with all the disease and illness. And were the sailors kept on ship to avoid them deserting if they put ashore?
It wasn't so bad in the West Indies because they were, of course, small populations.
Right.
The place that their kin was extremely keen that William should never go was the Mediterranean. The flesh pots of the Mediterranean were quite something. So he was always kept out of there.
So it wasn't wholly because the Mediterranean was more dangerous, more that there was a lot more vice to be enjoyed. So he was largely sent west.
He went back again, the West Indies, and again, because it was safer.
Right.
And he couldn't get up to quite so much trouble. Well, mind you, he did. He was always boisterous. He didn't think before he spoke. And he also was well known for fisticuffs. He was very often in trouble. So he actually quite took to the life, even in spite of its banishments and its roughnesses, its toughness. The boisterous William really took quite well to it. But his problem was that the only way he could see to be an officer was to punish people. And he was a flogger.
Right.
And it was extremely difficult to be a good naval officer, a good captain, a good effective captain. You had 200 men on board a 500-ton ship, maybe more than that. To keep those men happy and effective took a great deal of skill and thought, and of course there were very good ones. William was not, the way he could see of giving people the motivation to do the right thing was to flog them. That didn't get you very far.
I know he'd like to sort of play up the fact that he was a friend of Nelson. I mean, were they actually close friends?
For a time, they went in and out of friendship, and certainly in the West Indies in the 1780s, when Nelson was a very young officer, and William the same, he gave away the bride when Nelson got married in 1787. So there was that period. But through the 1790s, when Nelson wasn't really getting anywhere, he wrote to William, hoping that that would be helping with his promotion. And then that suddenly completely changed after the Battle of the Nile in 1798, when Nelson was much lauded and a huge hit. Suddenly, William started writing to him. They were completely different people.
So regarding Nelson, was he a great seaman, a great admiral, or was he just lucky? I mean, what was it that made him stand out and allowed him to defeat the French Navy time and again?
The British Navy was better built. Its weapons were better. There were all those sorts of things. So Nelson starts with a big, big advantage.
Yeah.
But what Nelson did do, in a way which was extremely unusual, was that he had a different style. He trusted people. He'd have them to dinner. He would get into their confidence and vice versa. I always think with Nelson that he was brought up in a small Norfolk town. He knew everybody, up to the gentry, down to the household labourers. He knew how to get on with people. He wasn't very good socially with the aristocracy, but he knew how to get on with them. And then he trusted them. And he basically said, once a battle has started, I can't do very much about it. But you can't do any wrong if you put yourself alongside the enemy. His ideas were very aggressive. And they knew where they were. Completely the opposite to William, who was a complete controller, or he tried to be. And so it was unusual what Nelson did in the 1790s. And then going into Trafalgar, he gave them the orders and then he said, off you go. And they slowly went into the French and Spanish fleet and they knew what they had to do. And they didn't want to let him down. He had that quality.
Well, as you say, that William lacked. And, you know, it seems that he spent the rest of his life trying to get back into service, that seemed to be the part of his life that he felt most fulfilled.
I think that's true, certainly early on. But then, of course, he didn't think what he was saying. He criticized the war. The politicians tried to keep him out and did so. And so he tried to get in, even to the point after Trafalgar, where he tried to get to be CNC in the Mediterranean, where Colling was keeping the whole of the southern flank of Europe in control. And Collingwood didn't come home. He was away all these years and he died out there.
Right, so this is Vice Admiral Cuthbert Collingwood, who was he was a partner with Lord Nelson, wasn't he, during the Napoleonic Wars, and a very able commander and diplomat, unlike William, I guess, and who for the last 7 years of his life was permanently away from England.
And the politicians wouldn't allow him home because they were worried that William would worm his way to being commander-in-chief. It would have been disastrous.
Who is in charge of making those decisions? Is that Admiralty? Is that Parliament?
It's the Admiralty, the First Lord of the Admiralty, and ultimately the Cabinet. But of course, they were overruled in the case of William by the King. But then, of course, what happened is that the old King had all these illnesses and he lost control of it. It all got rather weak in the middle, and in fact, remaining so for 20 or 30 years. The Navy was all right, but those appointments were really quite difficult. And it could quite possibly have been that William might have got in there. And this was all the time of the Regency, and it was all very difficult. Mm. However, he never did. They promoted him to all sorts of things which didn't mean anything until the 1820s. Right towards the end, well after the Napoleonic Wars, when he was made Lord High Admiral, which was this extraordinary old idea, which was a 17th century idea. Mm. And it happened because Canning was trying to form a ministry. He couldn't find anybody because everybody distrusted Canning. And so as a sort of last desperate move, he said to William, be Lord High Admiral. And of course, it was a complete and utter disaster. It didn't matter too much in that it was peace and nobody was threatening, but it was a big disaster.
Did he have some actual power in that role then?
He did. He did in theory. They gave him some advisors. Eventually, the Duke of Wellington became prime minister and got rid of him. But for 18 months, he was a complete loose cannon. The best example of all is he went down to Plymouth and took his queen down there. He took the underground ship out to Plymouth Sark, and there was lots of bands and ceremony, but the government didn't know where he was. It was a complete nonsense.
So he was like, I'm Lord High Admiral. I'm in charge here. I'm going to take this ship out and sail off around the world, and you can't do anything to stop me. And, instead of having toy ships to play with, he had an actual fleet.
Anyway, they eventually got rid of it. And so an ignoble naval career altogether. The Sailor King, which is what he was, but he wasn't much of one. It was all pretty disastrous.
And before he married Adelaide, his personal life was quite bizarre too, wasn't it?
He had a chaotic private life with Dorothy Jordan.
Yes, I mean, it looks like she was sort of supporting him.
There's no doubt about it. At that time, he had no money at all. The old king did relent and present them with Bushy House. But it was very sad. And she's a lovely woman, too trusting. And eventually, the problem then came is that it looked as though he might be heir to the throne with the old king. What did he do then? Well, he tried to find some heiresses. And that went on for some time. And leaving poor Dorothy Jordan. And then eventually they did find Princess Adelaide, who said yes. She was very young. But she was really determined. They married, I think, in 1818. And had they had children, of course, Victoria wouldn't have come to the throne. He wanted money out of his marriage and he wanted children. He didn't get either. His private life was a disaster too. But actually, Queen Adelaide was a very good thing for him. And he did quieten down. He did try and do something about money. He did get a bit more healthy, all because of her. And so life improved for him in the 1820s domestically, which was a very good thing because he suddenly found himself a big king. and nobody could have predicted that. And fortunately, by 1830, some of life's experiences all rubbed off on him. And he became, well, I think because he became king, he became much more stable and much quieter and didn't try and have a party all the time. And so there was a key moment.
And I suppose unlike his brother George, he had at least had some experience of the real world and other lives through his experiences in the Navy.
I think that absolutely critical. Yeah, absolutely critical. George IV was a recluse and had become very unpopular because nobody saw him. And one of the things that William IV didn't mind was walking around with people. He had a problem about walking around the streets. And so he came really at a point in his life where he began to accept things.
So at the time he becomes monarch, he is popular. And, I mean, it seems his popularity sort of went up and down quite a lot through the various constitutional crises around.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he had a very, very difficult time. He did some very sensible things. He cut a lot of costs from the court. He allowed people into parts of Windsor they'd never been allowed before, all the sort of popular things. And the governing classes also were very surprised that he quietened down a bit. But then he was, it's this very difficult 2 years when there's the immense pressure for reform, when the House of Commons was effectively, the Whigs got a large majority, there was a standoff. And on the whole, William was popular at the time because he was seen to be for reform. But then there was a question of making more peers to overcome the conservative anti-reformers. He did say, I can't do that. And so then there was an unpopular time again. But he did manage it. He had a very interesting relationship with Lord Grey, a Whig prime minister. Both of them, if you like, were rather outsiders in their life. And they both got on rather well. Whereas George III, George IV, for 70 years, had resisted all change, suddenly there was a reasonable person on the throne who was listening to people. And so he finally made his impact. He listened to them. He tried to get people to talk to each other who weren't talking to each other. And then finally he did say, I will make these peers. And at that point, the House of Lords gave way and the Reform Act came into being. The parliamentary representation was completely changed and Britain escaped revolution. Mm. The rest of Europe was going through very difficult times and there was revolution, although some of it was bloodless. And it suddenly got through it. And it was a critical time. And I don't think I would have put any money on William IV to have got through it. But he did so. And I suspect he did so because he had such a lot of disasters in his life. He had accepted that. And so he did listen to other people. But that's the interesting part of his character. And there was always, it always said, for instance, when he was a midshipman and he had all these fisticuffs and fights, he never bore a grudge. And there was that side to him, which fortunately came out in 1830. But I say I wouldn't have put any money on it.
Well, thank you so much, Roger, for talking to me about William, and I must say I greatly enjoyed your book. And I found so often with these kings that it's often, kings and queens, it's often the ones that you know least about that become the most fascinating.
Well, thank you very much. It was good to revisit it all again.
So that was Roger Knight, author of the book on King William IV in the Penguin Monarchs series. And it's a really good and fascinating read, which I'd completely recommend if you want to find out a bit more about the Sailor King. And if you want to find out more about William's relationship with Mrs. Jordan, the comic actress, Dora Jordan, who spent 20 years with William, there's an excellent biography of her written by Claire Tomalin called Mrs. Jordan's Profession. And in the next episode, we come to a much more familiar monarch, Queen Victoria, who will lead us right on into the 20th century. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.